Ideas matter. Ideas matter. This is Dialogue.
Hello and welcome to Dialogue. Demonstrations have been intensifying on college campuses across the United States, with students calling for a permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip and the cessation of the U.S. military aid to Israel. Despite certain U.S. politicians branding the demonstrators as anti-Semitic and hundreds of students being arrested, the anti-war protests continue to gain momentum, which have spread to the U.K. and France. Will the voices from U.S. college students make a difference on the ground in Gaza? How will the U.S. government respond to students' demands? And as Israel approves plans to invade Rafah, will the protests continue to escalate? Joining me today are Peter Kuznick, professor of history at American University, Robert Patillo, civil and human rights attorney, and Reid Baker, adjunct professor at Towson University. First, we'll talk to our correspondent Sally Patterson in New York. Hello, Sally. So tell us, what's the latest? What are the students calling for? I mean, how many universities are being affected?
Well, on Monday, we're hearing that up to 800 people have now been arrested over the past week or so. They've been joining pro-Palestinian protests across the United States. It really all started out here in New York at Columbia University, where a group of students set up an encampment on the college quad and basically said they refused to move until their university met three key demands. Firstly, what they want is for the university, Columbia University, to boycott Israeli companies and basically divest any money from going towards Israel, because this group says that that money, and therefore the university, is helping to fuel the ongoing war in Gaza. Secondly, what they wanted was they want complete transparency of where that money is going. They said that tuition fees and other money coming into the university should be open to all to see how it's being funneled and where it's ending up. Thirdly, these students said that they wanted complete amnesty for those students who, faculty members, I should say, who have been picked up over the past week or so and have either been turned over to the police or arrested or going through internal disciplinary procedures at the university. Those are the people protesting's three key demands, and they basically haven't shifted on those as of yet. Now, in response, we've seen from the university, when it first all started the week before last, quite a heavy-handed approach. They brought in the NYPD because the president of the university, Manoush Shafiq, basically said that this campaign, this protest, was causing what she called a clear and present danger to the ongoing work of the university. And so she basically called in the police to disperse them. Now, since then, we've seen ongoing negotiations between the university and the protesters. The protesters were told that anyone not associated with the campus needed to leave the university premises. And there has been some talk about that happening. They were also told over the past few days that the language and harassment that the university accused some of these protesters of using needed to end immediately. We've seen a spread of protests now across the country, more than 20 different campuses joining in these pro-Palestinian protests, calling for an end to the war in Gaza and saying they will not be moved and they will not be stopped until that's come to an end.
Mm-hmm. So, Sally, do you think, you know, some groups of students, maybe crossing the line in their support of Palestine or for Israel?
I will tell you what we've been hearing from students on the ground and from other people I've been speaking to when I've been up at the campuses. There is certainly a heightened sense of tension and of fear in some of these campuses. When I was up at Columbia University, the students that I was speaking to inside the encampment were mainly saying that this was a peaceful protest. They said they were simply refusing to move, but they were sitting around eating, drinking, camping. But they said that they had been acting peacefully and within the law. They said that this was part of their right to freedom of speech, to be able to engage in this kind of protest. Now, that's not what we've heard from others. For example, the New York Police Department says that when they went to respond to protests at New York University at the beginning of last week, they said they were met with things being thrown at them and abuse. And they said that the crowd actually got violent. And they said that's when they had to intervene and many, many arrests were made on that evening. And we've heard similar stories across the country with police being sent in, sometimes in full riot gear, because they said that the people that they're meeting there have become violent and there have been breaches to safety. The university has also, you know, universities across the country have also made similar allegations about some of these protesters. But on the whole, when I've been up there, there has been a general sense of peace. Part of that is because there is a real desire at the moment to keep the pro-Palestinian protesters and the counter-demonstrations separate as much as possible. At Columbia, those protesting who aren't a part of the university community have been kept outside of the college grounds. They're not allowed inside. Only the media are allowed in for a couple of hours a day. There are many students, particularly Jewish students, who say that they have been made to feel very unsafe over the past couple of weeks. Some of them saying they're not even willing to go onto campuses anymore because of what they say is a hostile reaction to them. They say that some of the chants, for example, being used by the pro-Palestinian demonstrators, calling for example, from the river to the sea, calling for Palestine to be free, many of them see that as calling for an end of the State of Israel. There have also been calls to, for example, bomb Tel Aviv. They say Zionists aren't welcome on our campus, words to that nature, which makes some Jewish and many Israeli students feel very unsafe. There is a small number of Jewish students who are taking part in the pro-Palestinian demonstrations as well. But what many Jewish students have been telling me is that they want a much stricter approach when it comes to some of these protests because they haven't felt safe. Now, over the weekend, we did see clashes, particularly in California, between these two different sides, if you will. The university said that sadly these peaceful demonstrations had got violent and one of these demonstrations had breached a barrier that had been set up in between them. We don't know any details of who that was and what happened there, but it's easy to see how this situation is escalating as the feelings are so intense on both sides.
Well, thank you, Sally, for the updates. Let's turn to our panel. So, Peter, I will start with you. You know, what exactly prompted this nationwide campus movement, for Gaza here?
Sally said it was sparked by the protests at Columbia. You have to realize that the students are seeing images. They don't watch so much mainstream television, but they do watch social media, and they're seeing horrific images of the Israeli military. You know, the official figure is that 34,000 Gazans have been killed in this uprising. But my sources tell me that's probably more than 50,000 because they're not counting all the people who are under the rubble. But these heartbreaking images day after day of Palestinians digging through the rubble and finding their dead children and dead friends and relatives. So it's a very much of a moral issue for the students, because 70% of the arms imports into Israel are coming from the United States. Another 30% almost from Germany. So the Americans feel responsible. The American students feel responsible for what their government, their tax dollars are doing here to make possible the slaughter of the Palestinians. So thrilled at these protests. I haven't seen this level of engagement from American college students since the 1960s, and it's long overdue. And I'm supporting their efforts and this idea that they're anti-Semitic and that they're or violent is really overblown. In many of these instances, it's the outside people, not the students, who are saying the hateful things. There's no place for anti-Semitism in America, really. It's certainly not on the colleges. And these are not violent protests. These are peaceful protests. So I'm very encouraged by what I've seen so far.
Robert, as Peter has said, the students are protecting the government policy in the sense for supporting Israel with arms while, basically there's what people call ongoing genocide in Gaza. People would say they represent actually the conscience of the nation. That's a good thing, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think people need to remember that college protests are as old as America are. You can look at the anti-global war on terror protests from 20 years ago. When I was out in the park, like these kids were protesting against the Bush administration's war in Afghanistan and Iraq, while many of our classmates got shipped off to the Middle East. You can look at the 1960s, the Kent State Massacre, where we had so many college students around the country, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, organized by John Lewis and others, that fought against the Vietnam War and fought for civil rights and human rights in the 1960s. You can go back to the Civil War, where students in the North protested against being drafted to go fight on the Southern Front. You can go to the Revolutionary War, where Tory Ivy League students protested against the idea of going to war with Great Britain. So the concept that somehow these students should not be standing up against human rights violations, should not be standing up against these efforts by the U.S. government, the antiquated policies going back to the era of Goldmayer, where the U.S. simply gave blanket assistance to Israel regardless of policy, I think everyone knows that rubric has gone out the window long ago. The Netanyahu regime announced itself as being the most far right-wing regime in Israeli history when they were inaugurated. They put together the judicial reforms that really slicked the tracks to get us to this point. It was the Netanyahu regime that, because of their expansionist policies, missed all the intelligence information that would have prevented October the 7th, and it is the Netanyahu regime that is using this as an opportunity not to stop Hamas, but to wholesale wipe out the Palestinian people. We've already heard Jared Kushner talk about how that beachfront resort property in Gaza will be some of the most valuable in the Middle East. And students see this, they understand this, and they fight back against this. This is part of the American tradition. This is why we have a First Amendment. And what we are seeing is that they are being effective. The Michigan and Wisconsin primaries, the non-committed movement was massive. Joe Biden, the president, has heard the call from these students. We're seeing American policy, both in the UN and in Congress, changing towards Israel. And I think if the students stand up, maintain this fight, we will see an end to this offensive prior to the destruction of Rafah.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ray, you know, as our reporter told us, you know, House Speaker Mike Johnson and other GOP lawmakers, you know, went to Columbia University basically to demand the university president to resign for failing to quickly dismantle pro-Palestinian encampments, you know, erected by students, and not doing enough to ensure Jewish students feel safe. I mean, people would ask, is it proper, is it right for representatives of the U.S. government to take such a rather bold and also quite harsh stance on one side or the other?
Well, yes, I do think that it's proper or right. And the reason I think that it's proper and right is that because the leadership of the United States political system is responsible for and committed to progressing and maintaining United States global hegemony and its position in the world. And any type of public disruption, this public protest, particularly the protest as Robert laid out for us just now, has always been met with resistance. The establishment rarely, if ever, welcomes protests, welcomes modifications, welcomes adjustment. And so it stands to reason that the Speaker of the House of Representatives in the United States would not want to see mass protests among college students engaging in a disagreement, a public disagreement, and in fact, public embarrassment of the public policies of the United States House of Representatives, the United States Senate, and the White House. The entire foreign policy apparatus in the United States is being embarrassed by these protests. So it stands to reason with very clear rationality why leadership of the United States public policy arm would want to go to these college campuses and quell that conversation. Now, this isn't a question of morality or justice, because we cannot pretend that empires operate in the space of morality and justice. We must acknowledge that empires exist to perpetuate their own positivity and power. In that vein, the Speaker of the House has every right and desire to go to these college campuses and is ostensibly telling the president of Columbia University and signaling to presidents of universities all across the nation, get your people under control. If you cannot, we have armed forces that are there to do that. That invites us to reflect on what does that say about the United States if that's the way that we adjudicate this discrepancy with our public policy, by bringing in our armed wing of enforcement to restrain protests mm-hmm. and get people back under control.
Well, Robert, I want your response to what Ray has said about, the public I expected to be in line with the government in terms of policymaking here, in terms of running of the state.
Well, he's correct. And for years, this was the way that the American public was, because we had only one side of the information. What we were seeing with the internet, as we've heard earlier, is the democratization of information. Before, it was simply this idea that Israel was always the victim, whoever was attacking were always the terrorists, and we needed to destroy them to protect because Israel had the right to exist. That's all well and good until you're starting to see footage on Rumble and Telegram and WhatsApp and other social media channels showing children being pulled from rubble. You know, 30 or something like 15,000 children, by the official estimate, have been killed during this offensive. And the response, as President Biden warned Netanyahu, has been disproportionate to the attack, to the point that the American people are now disagreeing with American foreign policy towards Israel that existed for 75 years. And I make this point to people often. There are four variants of the F-35 stealth fighter. There's the F-35A for the Air Force, B for the Marines, C for the Navy, and the F-35I for Israel. America is so intertwined with the Israeli military and Israeli foreign policy that they might as well be one and the same. So when these students are protesting against America, they are protesting directly against the military-industrial complex, which allows Israel to kill 15,000 Palestinian students. And that's where they're standing up to, the same way students stood up at Kent State in the 1960s, the same way the students have stood up throughout the history of America.
Well, Ray, what are the standards, what are the yardsticks for students like peacefully protesting, somehow crossing into the red line of breaking the law? Or, you know, if students are on the right side of history, don't you think they have a point in expressing their opinions, you know, which is, I believe, important to the country?
Certainly. And I think our first mistake may be thinking that the law is some type of polite or some type of objective measure. The law simply is whatever they who have power says it is. And whenever they who have power no longer like the behavior of the people who are their subjects, the law then changes. We've seen this a number of times through many of the various protest movements that some of our other panelists pointed us to, and I invite us to reconsider that the law can be fluid and malleable depending upon who has the power to determine this. In the United States, the state of Louisiana recently passed legislation that ostensibly makes organizing a mass protest illegal. That seems to be in direct contradiction to the First Amendment, and yet there are ways around federalism, there are ways around states' rights, and I use that term intentionally to evoke an older day in the United States, that makes that okay, that makes that a function of how this United States will operate and the various states within the United States will operate. Now, specifically to something that Dr. Kuznick said that I think he pointed out importantly for the audience to consider, is the hypocrisy of the United States colleges. The thing that our colleges purport themselves to do is to train and produce, as Dr. Kuznick said, enlightened and engaged citizens. Unfortunately, what these campus protests are demonstrating is that the function of the university here in the 21st century in the United States is about producing workers. And the number one thing that management wants out of workers is obedience and subservience. And I don't mean this in a great metaphorical sense. I mean this in a very literal sense. Workers who are too consumed with their work have no time to engage in the affairs of the world around them. So if and when they see something that troubles them morally, there's no time, space, or opportunity to take action. Collegiate students are the last bastion of hope that we have in the United States of people who are not so overworked that they actually have the opportunity, time, and space to engage in activism around moral and principled issues. That is exactly the idea that the university should be putting forward. Unfortunately, what we've seen is the hypocrisy that our panelists have alluded to, which is the university is organized around producing the next class of workers, and workers who are willing to say to their managers, workers who are willing to say to their bosses, workers who are willing to say to their leaders of any iteration, what you are doing is wrong and we want to have a conversation about it, we want to push back against it, and more importantly, we want change, is functionally inconsistent with what much of the 21st century neoliberal policies and practices of the broader United States. So the college students are activating an energy that many citizens throughout the country are feeling, not specifically and exclusively around the question of the horrors in Gaza, but wrapped up in all of the lived experience that so many of us in the United States are feeling, are the angst, anger, frustration, and advocacy of the young people on campuses across the nation. And the response from colleges are very, very telling as to what their purported purpose is versus what their functional purpose is.
So Robert, do you agree? So basically here at the center is the universities and also their way to cultivate the young generation?
Absolutely. And I'm somebody who was actually expelled from college as a student activist back in 2004. I had worked, and that's part of the reason I got involved in the civil rights movement, was this idea of the centering of college activism on our college campuses. So I understand why these students are there, but I also understand why it's important for them to be there. Look, activism has to be, in many places, illegal. Slavery was legal at the time. The abolitionists were illegal. The people who were sitting in at lunch counters were trespassing and breaking laws during the civil rights movement. The people shooting them with hoses and sending dogs on them were the law enforcement officials who were theoretically on the right side of the law. Remember the Selma to Montgomery march, John Lewis and many other protesters were beat upside the head and arrested for their activities. The people beating them were the people on the right side of the law. So this argument that these young people are doing something illegal doesn't hold weight historically. The law is good only so long as a man uses it lawfully, 1 Timothy 1:8. And part of the reason that we have to be cultivating this is that truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne, yet that scaffold sways the future. The reason of that these young people are out there because in the next 4, 10, 20 years, they're going to be controlling our political system. And the changes that are not taking place now, they're not long until they will be making those changes for us. The Mitch McConnells and the Donald Trumps and the Joe Bidens of the world won't be in leadership much longer compared to these young students. So their voices will be heard, whether it's now or in a decade. Just know that this is the clearing call that is coming. And we can either try to put these kids down with law enforcement and the National Guard, or we can listen to them now, bring them into the political process and make America better.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, with this campus, nationwide campus movement, and you know, what matters is really about the result, the outcome. You know, Peter, if you look at the, you know, the Vietnam War or the movement against the war in the 1960s, 1970s, you know, people would say the demonstration at campus, you know, helped shift the public opinion leading up to the withdrawal of the U.S. troops, you know, out of you know, Vietnam. And how do you think the current in the campus movement will end up?
I think it's already having an important impact. I mean, Biden better wake up. Biden warns against the tyranny that Trump represents, yet Biden is alienating several of the constituencies that he needs in order to win in this election. And I'm not a fan of Biden's, as you know, but this policy is self-defeating. And young people, they might not vote for Trump, but a lot of them are certainly not gonna vote for Biden. Biden won overwhelmingly in that demographic back in 2020. And he's doing very poorly in the polling in that demographic now. And they see the hypocrisy. They see the U.S. role. They think of Biden as effectively a moral imbecile with his refusing to cut off the flow of arms to Israel at a time when the International Court of Justice even says that it looks like this could be a genocide. And whether it's a genocide or just a slaughter, you just think of the irony here. You've got Israel, a country that was founded on the heels of the Holocaust, from many people who are Holocaust survivors, being given arms right now by the United States, founded in genocide against Native Americans, and Germany, who perpetrated the genocide, the Holocaust during World War II and before. So, I mean, we're in globally, the moral issues are very clear. And it's very clear to the students, and it's very clear to the faculties at these universities. And so, if Biden doesn't wake up and change his policy soon, he's going to not only lose that demographic, but he's going to put Trump in the White House just so he can continue his support for Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, finally, you know, Peter, considering these strong voices in the U.S. campus, you know, that are against supporting basically the government's policy, you know, supporting Israel militarily, and also, you know, internationally, there's an increasing call for the U.S. to play a role, I would say a positive role, to apply some pressure on Israel to achieve at least a ceasefire, if not a permanent one. Why is it so difficult for the Biden administration to adjust or readjust its policy on Israel, on Gaza here?
Well, you have to remember that Biden had received more money from AIPAC and the Israel lobby than anybody else in the Senate for many, many decades. Biden has a long history of being closely aligned with Israel, a strong supporter of Israel. Biden, you know, is very hawkish in a lot of ways. We see his policies in terms of Ukraine. We see his policies in terms of Taiwan, the militarization of the Pacific, as well as this area, as well as Gaza. Across the board, he's been very hawkish. His advisors are very hawkish. Biden, it should be a very simple equation, a very simple moral equation for Biden to break with Netanyahu. The problem is that Biden talks to Netanyahu and Netanyahu doesn't listen. And even if Biden is sincere in his attempts to restrain Netanyahu, Biden's words and those of Blinken and Sullivan and Austin are being ignored. And so that's why Biden has got to stop placating these people. As my colleagues have said, what Netanyahu represents is the most extreme right-wing government in Israel's history. And we're talking about far-right fascistic elements in that administration, and many of whom, some of whom at least, do want to wipe out the Palestinians and do want to retake that territory, which Israel vacated two decades ago. And so Biden needs to get a backbone. He needs to stand up to Netanyahu. He needs to cut off U.S. arms to Israel. And he needs to put pressure for a ceasefire and for really moving toward a two-state solution as quickly as possible. But we have not seen that kind of resolve, leadership, morality, on or conscience on Biden's part, and it's very tragic. And the students see the hypocrisy, as do many other Americans.
Well, on that note, we come to the end of today's discussion. Many thanks to our guests. You can also find us on the CGTN app on YouTube. I'm Xu Qingduo. Thanks for being with us. See you next time.
Get a balanced analysis on both domestic and international topics within the framework of cross-cultural comparisons. This is Dialogue.